extravagant promises. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. Thank you all.
Okay, and now to our main attraction. I've known Chris ever since I walked in these doors. He was here before I was, but I'm going to let Mr. Greg come up and introduce our speaker for us.
Hey, I'm Greg. I'm a grateful alcoholic. Good morning. This program's given me a lot of gifts, but at the top of the list is the best friend, Chris. And I'm so honored to be able to introduce him tonight. As a matter of introduction, I just want to say a quick story about Chris. Chris and I, we met several years ago, and we hit it off pretty good. We bonded pretty good, and he invited me to do something that I wasn't familiar with, and that was to go hiking. So he took me up to Enchanted Rock, and we were hiking around, we were bonding, and we didn't know each other that well. And he said something to me. He said, "Greg," and I go, "Yes, Chris." And he said, "You see that tree over there?" And I said, "Yes." And he goes, "Would you like to go and listen to that tree?" And I said, well, first thought was, man, I don't know him that well, and there's no one else around. What's going on here? But I went with it, okay? I'm learning to be open-minded. So we walked over that tree, and I put my ear up next to the overhanging branch. But Chris, he got all up in there, and he put his ear right up next to the trunk. And we were there, it seemed like an hour, but it's probably 2 or 3 minutes. And we left, and we were walking along, and Chris said, "So, Greg, what did that tree say to you?" True story, guys, okay? And I said, "Well, Chris, I was in the present, and there wasn't a lot of distractions, and it was peaceful, but to be honest with you, bud, I'm not really sure that tree said anything to me, okay?" And we continued walking along, and I was dying inside, and I said, couldn't stand it any longer. I said, "Chris, what did that tree say to you?" And he looked at me. We stopped, and he goes, "Greg, that tree told me everything was going to be okay." And I've had the distinct privilege, gift, to watch Chris, who's so plugged into this program, tell hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that everything's going to be okay. Let's everybody give a warm welcome to Chris.
Man, he's in fuego today. Let's have him speak. Come on, Greg, you get back up here. Let's do it. Yeah, good Lord. Yeah, my name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Chris!
Through an honest effort to follow 12 recommended steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the fellowship of the program by the grace of God. I've been sober since July 24th, 1999. So, 20 years this year. I sobered up in that room right over there. And this place really means a lot to me. It's meant a lot to my family, who's my wife and I. And my wife manages the Al-Anon office here. Her name's Pat. And she loves it when people come in and interrupt her all day long, asking for advice and what to do and what books to buy and what to do about their drunk husband. So feel free to go in there and ask her any time of day, night and day. She really loves that. Yeah. Yeah, it's been a couple of years since I've spoken here, 3 or 4, I guess. And so, first, I wanted to apologize for everything I said last time. It was true then; it's not anymore. But so please accept my apology for that. And remember, one of the first times I spoke was at the Highlands Group when it was down on the southeast side, and my friend Jesse told me, "Okay, Chris." This I was real new. He said, "You'll know how you're doing. There's a man named Roger L. He'll be sitting in the third row, and he'll be very intently listening, and you'll be able to tell how you're doing based on his facial expressions." I said, "All right, great." So I get up there, and I start running my mouth. And Roger sits there the whole time like this. The entire time I'm talking. God, I'm bombing here. And finally, I had to quit early. I knew I was bombing. It was awful. And so I came back the next week, and there was a speaker up there speaking, and I looked at Roger to see how he responded to a good speaker. That's how he sat at the meeting. So Yeah, very encouraging. Once I was in Cozumel, I was 90 days sober. And my wife and I, we went with some people to Cozumel, and I was still Looney Tunes. But thank God, in Cozumel, there's an English language meeting. And so I started going there. I guess we got there on a Tuesday or Wednesday. So Tuesday, Wednesday nights, Thursday night, I'm at the meeting. And man, it was great. And it was all these Americans and Canadians, 20, 30, 40 years sober. I mean, you go to meetings at resort places like that, it's generally people have been sober for a long time. And so they're all at the meeting, and I'm there too. And the guy who's chairing it comes up to me and says, tomorrow night's our speaker meeting. Would you like to be the speaker? I said, oh, well, no. Why not? I said, well, geez, I only have 89 days today. And he said, oh, well, tomorrow you'll have 90, right? I said, yeah. He says, all you need is 90 to be the speaker. So I got up there and told my little story as I understood it then. And the reaction of all the people with 20, 30 years sober afterwards was this. After the meeting, all pounded me on the back and said, don't drink. Don't drink. So I'm hoping I have a better reaction than that at the end of this. All right. So anyhow. All right. What do I was like? Well, I grew up in upstate New York, the first of four. I'm the oldest of four. My parents were in college when Chris happened. Surprise! Right? And when I happened, I learned from a very early age. I was reminded that, Chris, remember, accidents cause people. Right? All right. So anybody looking for parenting advice, you might not lay that on your seven-year-old. All right? You might not do that. So I've had enough therapy to, kind of work through all that. But kind of what that sort of thing set off in me early on was a need to be accepted, a need to achieve, and a need for affirmation. Anybody familiar with the Enneagram? The Enneagram? I'm an Enneagram 3, which is a need to achieve. And how about the love languages? You heard the five love languages? I've taken that test, and my love language is words of affirmation, right? Words of affirmation. So if you want to get on my good side, affirm me, right? Tell me how I'm achieving. I'm doing a great job. So the big book calls it something else, though. The big book says this, page 61. Chris is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. He's forever trying to run to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if people would only do as he wished, the show would be great. Everyone, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. Yeah, so I might be an Enneagram 3. I might have words of affirmation as my love language, but I'm also the actor trying to run the whole show. And if I perceive that you don't like me, I'll do anything in my power to get you to like me to the point of making you not like me. That came out on my inventory, right? Yeah. Yeah, fear of people being mad at me, right? Wow. Because I would do anything in my power to get you to not be mad at me to the point of you being mad at me. So, perfected that art. Anyhow, so I walked around life as a little kid and into my early teenage years, with squirrels in my head and knots in my stomach, nervous disposition. But I discovered something when I was 13 years old that would untie the knots and slow down the squirrels. That was a drink. Right? 13 years old, eighth grade, around a bonfire in the woods somewhere. DeKuyper Slow Gin and Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill Wine. Nice, huh? Yeah. Mm. Well, that was 45 years ago. Right? 45 years ago. I just told you the brands I drank 45 years ago. I can't remember what I had for lunch yesterday. I might be an alcoholic. You think? I might be. Yeah, it worked, man. If you're an alcoholic, you can relate to this. Kind of restless, irritable, discontent, squirrels, knots. Open that first beer, take a sip. Ah, sweet relief. Yeah. Who cares if I'm achieving? Who cares if you like me? Ah, sweet relief. Yeah, all's well with the world. Anybody relate to that? Can I get an amen, Constance? Yeah, it worked like that for a long time. Yeah. Drugs wasn't part of my thing. I smoked weed and I thought I would hallucinate, you know, smoking weed. You know, did cocaine and like once, I thought I was going to die of a heart attack. In fact, I remember my sobriety date from that. It was April the 5th, 1986. And the way I remember that is because it's imprinted on the inside of my wedding ring, because that was my wedding day. And so, yeah, my friends from New York came, oh yeah, let's do this. You know, that makes a lot of sense, right? And I laid in bed all night, you know, not like I'm nervous because I'm getting married the next day anyway, but laid there at some hotel here, all the blinds drawn and everything else is pitch dark, can't sleep. So, man, this stuff is not for me. Not for me. So, yeah, so I've been sober from that for all these years. And I didn't have to go to a lot of meetings about that either. Right? I didn't have to go to all these damn meetings. Right? But drinking's my thing. I mean, and it has been since it started working. And that's why it's my thing, because it worked. If you're an alcoholic, like I'm an alcoholic, you drink because it works. It works. And I mean, the big book nailed me, the doctor's opinion. Restless, irritable, and discontent. Unless I can once again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes by taking a few drinks. Drinks others take with impunity. My wife, she'd have a drink and a half. She'd get a little giddy. She'd go to bed, right? I have a drink or two. And I go to town. Anybody have to have a couple drinks before you go out drinking? Yeah. You get it. Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I've got to tell you, you all are looking good since you quit all that drinking and screwing around. You really are. You really are. Anyway, the drinking lasted. It worked for me for a long time. And I had a career where I achieved, got married again in 1986. We're still married, my wife, God bless her. And happily all these years. And that's by the grace of God for sure. But through my, you know, years of achievement, I'm in the outdoor advertising business. I'm the guy, billboards, right? If you don't like him, I'm the guy. Blame me. And yeah, so I've been involved in that my whole career, and had some success with that. And but I drank from the time I was 13 years old till the time I was 38, and it worked. But then, you know, it starts to turn on you at some point. And I'm not sure exactly when that point was with me, but when I decided that I had to drink, and when I kind of like crossed the line and I had to, probably early on, you know, in college I drank all the time. I wasn't a blackout drunk. And I didn't live under the bridge. I didn't have a DWI. I was never divorced and I never went bankrupt and all that stuff. And but I remember when I first showed up here, I was standing right by that pole right there. And I was telling Traveling Hank. Everybody know Hank? Hank, yes? Traveling Hank, friend of the working girl. Right there. Right there. And I told him all these things. I know none of this stuff had ever happened to me. And he said this word, yet. I thought, yeah, yet. Yeah, you're eligible too. Yeah, I could see that. Because I could see where it was heading that way. It was heading that way. Drinking was accepted around my house. My dad's he's a drunk, you know, and I'm still so much in denial about that. I mean, he's a drunk. It's hard for me to say that, but he is. He's an alcoholic. And he's always kept it somewhat under control because my mother's such an unrecovered Al-Anon. She's made sure that that's happened. But, you know, Dad was a drinking buddy from early on. I remember in high school, It was senior prom day. And I'm sitting there in the living room with my dad and my friend Walt Pimbley. And I'm wearing my powder blue 100% polyester tuxedo, looking sharp, right? And Walt's in his yellow one. And we're there, and we're drinking black velvet and ginger ale with my dad, Canadian rye whiskey, I guess. My dad says, here's his words of advice as we go out to our senior prom. Boys, don't mix the grape and the grain. What? Don't mix the grape and the grain. So, well, what does that mean? Well, this is made out of grain. Wine is made out of grapes. If you drink them together, you get too hammered. All right? Don't mix. Drink one or the other. And then you can drink more and be okay. Now, most fathers, if their son was going off to the senior prom, would say, boys, don't drink and drive, right? You would think. No, drink one or the other, that way you can drink more. Gee, thanks, Dad. Yeah, great advice. Yeah. And remember, Chris, accidents cause people. Yeah. Yeah, that too. Yeah. So it was accepted around my house. Actually expected, I think. Anyhow. So my early adulthood, it goes fairly well until I get into my 30s. We had lived in Miami for a while. We came back here. I'm managing a company. It was sort of a high-stress situation. But I really didn't need an excuse to drink. I drank. That's what I did. And then I started playing. I've been a guitar player my whole life. I started playing in a bar band. And, you know, in the big book it talks about we started to seek out sordid places. Well, I would say the Make My Day Lounge and Drug Distribution Center over there on Parabital and Nacogdoches. That kind of fits the bill there. That was one of the places we used to play. And there, fiascos on Thousand Oaks. Anybody remember the Carousel Club and Methamphetamine Distribution Center over on over on Parabital? Yeah, we were regulars there. Yeah, but that afforded me the opportunity to be in environments where I wasn't just sitting on my couch drinking. You know, I was out working, right? Playing in the bar band, working and drinking. So I did that several nights a week, and things kind of started going downhill from there. I started to have panic attacks on airplanes, and I started to be depressed, and I started to see a psychiatrist and a psychologist and a pharmacist to try to get my head together, and nothing was working. Nothing was working. Remember the first time I had a panic attack? It was in the airport in Orlando, I guess, and on standby, and I finally get a seat on this plane, and it's the last row. It was one of those planes that had like 3-5-3, right? And I'm in the middle of 5 in the back row, hungover. It's hot, and I sit down, and then all of a sudden, feeling of blood coming from my toes up through my whole body into my face, covering my head, and not being able to breathe happened, right? And I'm between two big guys, right? And I am stuck in this thing. So I pulled my briefcase out, hit one of the big guys in the head with it accidentally, and I got off the plane. I went down to the concourse, and I got the paramedics. I went to the gate agent. They got the paramedics, and I'm laying down there, and they put an EKG on me. And I think I'm having a heart attack. Am I having a heart attack? They said, no, sir, you're having an anxiety attack. I said, really, what do I do about that? Well, sir, we suggest you not drink anymore today. Yeah, right. Sure. Yeah. So they put me on the next flight in first class with a stop in St. Louis. And what's the best thing about first class? Yeah. They told me not to drink anymore today. Come on, give me a break. Yeah. Anyway, that started happening more and more. And so I started seeking the professional help, and none of that was working. And I was in trouble, and I knew it. And I could not stop drinking. Then my bottom happened kind of in two phases. Phase one was on the couch the month of June, July, 1999. And that month on HBO, they showed the movie Groundhog Day. Remember Groundhog Day, Bill Murray?
Yeah.
That's the same day over and over and over again. And so I leave there. I watched that movie 6 or 7 times that month, laying there on the couch drinking. I thought, man, there's just something there for me. Because every day was like that. I would wake up in the morning and say, I'm not going to drink, I'm not going to drink, I'm not going to drink. And then at night, I'd end up drinking. No matter how much I didn't want to, I did anyway. No matter how bad the hangover was, I did anyway. I remember one night, I said, I'm not drinking tonight, damn it. It's a Tuesday night. Got to work tomorrow. I'm going to stay home. What am I going to do? I know I'm going to watch television with my wife. That's what I'm going to do. What's on? No, great. Travel Channel. Not Travel Channel. No. Lifetime Television for Women. Great. So, you know, the movie about an Al-Anon who's going to burn down his, you know, her drunk husband's bed or something, right? Okay. So a drink will fix this. Out in the garage. Get the Miller Lite. Yeah. The movie's not so bad after 3 or 4. You know, I can do this. I remember another time. I'm not going to drink, damn it. It's Tuesday night. Got to be on an airplane tomorrow. I'm not going to do it. An old college friend calls, right? Hello. Ah, blah, blah, blah. Without even consciously pouring my first drink, I was pouring my third drink. I didn't even consciously pour anything. Just on the phone talking. It was just an automatic reaction. I thought, man, something's a little screwed up here. Something's a little screwed up. Then I was on my couch. I had sold a company, so I had some money. And dangerous. Drunk with money and nothing to do, right? That's dangerous. So I had some money. It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Tuesday. And I'm sitting on the couch, 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Tuesday when most people are working. And I'm watching the Travel Channel. And, oh, great, they're going to Italy. Always wanted to go to Italy. Oh, better yet, they're going to the Piedmont of Italy, northern Italy. It's where they make Barbaresco, kind of wine that comes from that region. I have some Barbaresco here. Oh, that's terrific. So, you know, I go and pour myself a big glass of Barbaresco. You know, the nose, all that, right? Drinking my Barbaresco. Then I think to myself, well, I can't go to Italy because I would have a panic attack on the airplane. I'd never make it. But I can sit here and drink wine from the region and experience it through the television. Thank God for cable TV. And I thought, this is insane, right? This is what my life has come to. You know? Tuesday afternoon at 1 o'clock, drinking wine, watching the Travel Channel. That's the best I can do. I mean, something's got to change. And, so, there was a man that I knew. His name was Bill D. And he was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous since either 1953 or 55. I can't remember. I think he sobered up in 53, relapsed, and then again in 1955, I think. In New York, as a young man at the 24th Street Club in New York City. And I knew him from business for like 12 years before all this happened. And I knew he didn't drink, but and I knew that because we'd play golf, and then afterwards I'd get hammered, and he wouldn't drink. So I would drink in front of the guy. And I also knew he was sort of a religious zealot, I thought, because I had seen him on cable TV being interviewed by Pat Robertson once. And so that scared me a little. But I drank in front of the guy, and he never once said anything about my drinking. Well, we had a mutual friend who is my business partner and still is to this day in a business, and he used to work for this guy. And so he had told Mike, my partner, that, you know, when Chris is ready, have him call me. And I didn't know any of this at the time. Have him call me. And so it was the day before I showed up to AA, and I had a hangover, and I woke up, and I decided that morning that I needed to find some spiritual path to get better. I'd been exposed to some things that had convinced me that a spiritual path would help me get better. And by getting better at this point, all I'm talking about is panic attacks and depression, right, at this point. I'm not even thinking about the drinking yet. And so I decided I needed to find a new spiritual path. So, and going to church with my wife, you know, just wasn't doing it for me. So I needed to find a new religion. So I went to the Shepherd Shop, the Christian bookstore, and I got Frank Beard's book, The Big Book of American Denominations. It's a Saturday morning, and I started reading it. Alrighty. African American Anglican. That might be for me. What do they believe? Well, maybe not. Judaism. What do they believe? I don't know. I call my dad. Dad, what do Presbyterians believe? Oh, nothing? Okay. All right, good. Whatever you want? Okay, good. Methodists. Well, Mike's a Methodist. I think I'll call him. So I call my business partner, Mike. Mike, what do Methodists believe in? Chris, why are you asking? I said, well, I need some sort of spiritual thing to happen so I can get better and not be depressed and have panic attacks. He said, Chris, hang on for a second. I want you to talk to somebody. So he puts a woman on the phone. Her name's Liz. Now, Liz, who I've never met before, you know, I tell her what's going on with me, and I think Mike had primed her a little bit too. Turned out that she had all the same things going on with her I had going on with me. Right? She was depressed and had panic attacks and was seeing a psychiatrist, a psychologist, and a pharmacist, and had drank too much and felt like she had a hole in her soul and all this stuff. As she was talking to me, I kept looking at the phone. I don't know what this does, but kind of like I'm looking at myself in the mirror, like, what is this, right? As she's telling me her story. But at this point, she was doing better because she had 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And her life changed when she made that decision to go there, and it was getting better and better and better. So that got me to thinking, all right, maybe if I can get a handle on this drinking thing, maybe the other stuff I'm doing to get my head to feel better will work. So she put Mike back on the phone, and I said, Mike, what's Bill D's phone number? I think I need to talk to him. He gave it to me. So I called Bill. Now remember, Bill had seen me drink. He'd seen me get drunk. He'd never once said anything, ever. So I called him on the phone, and I said, Bill, it's Chris. I think the party's over. He said, I've been waiting for your call, right? See, he'd seen a few clowns like me, you know, between 1955 and 1999, you know. He'd seen a few guys. He knew it wouldn't make a hill of beans of difference if he said anything to me before that moment. He knew it wasn't going to make any difference. Now, he made sure that people around me kind of knew of him as a resource to go to, right? And then he was there and ready when I called. And then he took me. He said, Chris, meet me at Club 12 tomorrow. There's a 5:30 meeting. Come at 5 o'clock. We'll sit down with some guys, and we'll have dinner. So I said, hey, I can do that. I'm familiar with these kind of businessman lunch clubs, right? You know, kind of like the one on the top of the Frost Bank building downtown. You know, businessmen get together and have, you know, some drinks and maybe have dinner or maybe have lunch, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah, it's probably like that. I'll get together with some guys and we'll do that. And I show up here, right? Now, there are some businessmen here, right? And you can have lunch, yeah, if you care to. But I wouldn't consider this a businessman's lunch club, you know, like the one on the top of the Frost Bank building. So anyway, so I come in here. And we sit right over there, and we chat a little, and you know. Then I discover, oh God, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Well, this looks different than the Alcoholics Anonymous that I had in my mind, you know. That one was sitting in a dark, dingy room. Well, maybe that part was right, but dark with you know, red, gray, and black and white, and watching film strips of guys with bad livers, right? Saying, this could be you, you know, get smart, get saved, you know, that sort of thing. That's what I thought AA was. And but then I show up here and then go into the meeting and get a desire chip. I don't remember that part, but all I do remember, two things from that meeting. I remember Bill D., when he shared, saying that if you're new, And I've seen a lot of new people. And in fact, every one of them that I can remember came to AA as the result of the prayers of someone. Might have been a wife, might have been a mother, might have been a judge, right? But everyone who ever shows up is here as the results of the prayers of someone. I later found out that to be true about me. I remember that. Then I remember the woman sitting next to me, who just celebrated 22 years here recently, Hippie Wendy. And Wendy S., Hippie Wendy, sitting two chairs away from me, empty chair between us. She shared this: listen for the similarities, not the differences. Because it would have been really easy for me to difference myself out of the room. My God, Hank got hit by a train, for God's sakes, right? You know, I never got hit by a train. You know, there were people in their 560 WIs, all that stuff, you know. And listen for the similar. You know, that wasn't me. That wasn't me. You know, I thought an alcoholic was a guy drinking schnapps out of a brown paper bag underneath the bridge, wearing a trench coat, you know. It wasn't until later I remembered one time my friend Chuck and I being at a Madonna concert in the Orange Bowl in Miami, right? And surrounded by a bunch of 14-year-olds and their mothers. And it's raining, and I was wearing a trench coat, and I was drinking schnapps out of a brown paper bag. Kind of creepy, huh? Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what I thought. You know, it wasn't me. I had all my money. I had my cars. I had my house. I had my cats. I had my wife. You know, in my business, and but listen for the similarities, not the differences. And here were the similarities that when I wanted to stop, days when I said, I'm not drinking tonight, damn it, I drank anyway. Right? That was a similarity. And then, when I couldn't honestly predict how much I was going to have when I did start, something happened inside. You know, I have one. And then, sweet relief. Let's have more. You know? There's a story in the back of the big book where the woman talks about she was trying to enjoy and control her drinking, or else control and enjoy her drinking. And that was me too, you know? Every time I tried to control it, I couldn't enjoy it. You know? Chris, did you drink at lunch? Well, no. Well, why not? Well, because if I had one at lunch, I'd just feel lousy. And then if I had enough to not feel lousy, then I wouldn't go back to work, right? Yeah, that phenomenon of craving. Yeah. And in the back of the big book, the woman, she talks about going to a Super Bowl party and says, I'm gonna just blow it out here, right? I'm going to blow it out. I'm going to enjoy it, right? I'm going to enjoy my drinking. Then she woke up hungover, passed out on the couch the next morning. Yeah, I get that. You know, if she was enjoying it, she couldn't control it. Then she went to a hockey game 2 days later and wanted to control it because she was with clients and have won, and she just felt crappy. She couldn't enjoy it. That was me. And that was me. And that's all that mattered. That's all. It didn't matter if I was under the bridge. None of that mattered. None of that mattered. So I came out of that meeting and... you know, I want you to note something. It's now 12 minutes to noon, and I've gotten sober. I haven't just done my drunk-a-log till noon like I usually do. So I'm really happy about that. So now I'm in AA. It's my first day. Now, hopefully I can get past my first day here before noon. But anyway, so then Bill D. takes me out to dinner with a couple guys. And so we go over to Los Barrios, and... I can't remember the first two guys' names, and they didn't stay sober, but the third guy did, and his name's Danny M. Dumpster Danny, Under the Bridge Danny. You may know who I'm referring to. And so all these people did while we sat there, they didn't want to hear anything from me. They just talked about themselves, God, for the whole time we're sitting there, telling their stories, right? And I'm thinking, God, these people are so self-centered. All they do is talk about themselves. I was like this, and then this is what happened, and now this is what I'm like now. I'm like, who cares? Don't you want to hear about me? Right? My God, let me tell you. And so then Bill says, okay, Chris, well, tell us about you. And I do, and I pull my Ativan out of my pocket, and I put it on the table and show him that. And, you know, talk about psychiatrist, psychologist, and pharmacist, and my type A personality, and my need for affirmation, and all this crap. And then it's Danny's turn to share. Bill says, how about you, Danny? And Danny says, he doesn't want to hear what I have to share. I said, well, sure I do, good man. You know, penny for your thoughts. I said, all right. He says, I think you're boring. Boring? Yeah, you're boring. You're just like every other drunk I ever hear from. So you're boring. And in fact, you're just like me. I'm thinking, just like him. I had heard a little of his story already. You know, I mean, he drank Thunderbird wine. I was a wine collector. He lived under a bridge. He worked at the plasma, right? He'd been to detox 17 times. But, you know, how am I like him? How am I like you? He said, yeah, you're just like me. You think you're all these things. A wine collector, businessman, under the care of professionals. As I tell you what you really are, you're just like me. You're a wino crybaby who runs to his high-priced drug dealer every time he doesn't get his way. Why is he being so mean to me? Well, because that was the truth. You know? That was step one for me right there. And I admitted that. I mean, what he said was absolutely true. And somebody said you can't BS the BSers. And he was a king BSer, but he was right on the money. He told the truth, and he told the truth about me. And that nailed me right there and then. And, yeah, that was it. That was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not sure that's in the big book anywhere. Tell your prospect he's a wino crybaby who runs to his high-priced drug dealer. It doesn't say quite that, but he was telling the truth. Because he knew the truth. You know, the psychiatrists and the psychologists, they didn't know the truth. Chris, do you drink? Well, yes. Well, how much? Well, moderately, but often. Oh, okay. Right? You know, because that's what I thought was true, you know. Doctor, you've made a horrible mistake. This antidepressant says do not drink alcohol while you're taking this antidepressant. Well, Chris, you know, do you drink? Well, yes. How much? Moderately, but often. Said, oh, don't worry about that. They just put that on there to scare you. Like, okay, great. But Danny told me the truth because he knew the truth because he was an alcoholic like I am. And so I started coming to meetings and right here in this place. And thank God, you might know there's a few meetings a day here. Right? And I used to go to all of them. I eventually chaired all of them every day. But, you know, that's part of the process. And I would come to the 11 o'clock. 12:15 used to be in there. And that's where I met Dr. Ray. Met Big Book Dick, my sponsor, in that room. I met Ben Cartwright, who was my spiritual advisor, in that room, back when those were was the smoking room. Met a guy named Mark who still comes around here in the 10 o'clock meeting back there. And he used to say this in meetings, and I learned this very early on, maybe my third day. He said that what he did, and he had 10 years sober at the time, was every morning he asked God to keep him sane and sober. And every night he thanked God for a good day of sobriety, even if the day sucked. And I started doing that probably July 27th, 1999, and I haven't missed a day. I do that every day. That's part of my routine. And everybody I know that does that, it seems to work. I even remembered after I started doing it. Back when I was still drinking, you know, if I really, really, really wasn't going to drink that night, I would pray. I'd say, God, please help me not drink tonight. And that seemed to work, right? I can remember, you know, a number of times when I wouldn't drink. I didn't say that prayer often, but when I did, I could see that would work. Now, there were other times I would pray, God, please help me not drink too much tonight. Right? And he never honored that prayer for some reason. I don't know. But they told me in there that zebras have stripes and alcoholics drink, and it takes an act of God to change either. And I thought, I'm screwed. I missed that class growing up, right? God this, God that. Oh, my goodness. One of these things. This is, you know, like Bill D., who's on the 700 Club. Oh, my God, it's one of these things. And I'm not there. I miss that. Right? My wife is religious, church going, all that stuff. That did not happen for me. I didn't. We went as a little kid. I never got it, and I just didn't get it. You know, I thought to be in good standing with God, what you needed to do was go to a bunch of classes and then have somebody in authority deem you worthy of being with God, right? Maybe get a little diploma and get your photo made with that person in authority, and then go out back and have a potluck lunch, right? Isn't that how you get good with God? You get confirmed or something, right? None of that had happened for me. And so I thought, well, how is this going to happen for me? And that's when Big Book Dick stepped in. And he said this: the process yields the results, right? I don't have to know God to get to know God. What I need to do is drink too much for too long, have it not work anymore, give up, surrender, ask somebody for help, and then take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's how it happened, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Yeah, that's what happened. I learned I didn't have to have clean hands before I used the soap either, right? I could start to get cleaned up in these step 4 and 5 and 6, 7, 8, 9. I learned I didn't have to know God to get to know God. I learned the process yields the results. It can happen for anybody, you know, whether you're Traveling Hank or whether you're Need of Affirmation Chris, whatever you want to call me. Yeah. Arrogant Chris, Turquoise Chris, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, it can happen for anyone. I'm grateful for that. All right, to skip to today, since we have 3 minutes, is today I'm 20 years sober. I'm active in AA. I go to a meeting of some sort every day. I have a home group. It's the Castle Hills group. It meets 7:15 on Monday nights at Covenant Presbyterian Church right over here on 410 and near Northwest Military. I went for about 12 years as the assistant treasurer. No, the alternate treasurer of that group. That was my service commitment. Alternate treasurer. Dr. Ray was the treasurer for all these years. And he used to joke with him, well, what do you do with the money? You probably just throw it in your sock drawer and spend it every now and then, don't you? Right? Well, when he passed and I was promoted to treasurer of the group, and I got the money and I got his records, the man for 12 years, or maybe more, had written down on a ledger what had come in every single meeting, right? How many people were at the meeting, and every expenditure the group had ever made on a ledger, right? And I couldn't believe it. You know, I thought he was just in a sock drawer. Guess where the treasury of the Castle Hills group is now? In my sock drawer. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, that's my home group. I'm also involved with something, and I have been since 2001, and I'll just give this a quick plug, called the Pioneer Group. And it's not an AA group, but a bunch of AAs got together and formed this thing. After I sobered up, I went to the Bulverde Group for their anniversary, my first year of sobriety. There was a guy named D.D. Lewis. He uses his whole name. He's been sober. He had been sober then like 25 years, and he used to play linebacker for the Dallas Cowboys. And he says his claim to fame is you can still see him in every video. It's him chasing Joe Montana right before Joe Montana throws the football to Dwight Clark for the catch. Remember that play when the San Francisco beat the Cowboys in the NFC Championship game? It's like one of the most famous plays in NFL history. And he says he's the guy chasing after Joe Montana and not getting to him. Anyway, that's his claim to football fame. But he said something at that meeting that really, really hit me. And it was, he said, you know what? And the Big Book talks about it, about how we in AA, people in recovery, can be a great help to people who are in ministry. And, you know, we have the kind of spirituality and spiritual practice that people that are pastors and priests and rabbis and ministers, you know, would just dream that their congregations would have. You know, I'm real active in the Methodist Church now, and, you know, they have meetings, and they have conferences, and they have all kinds of things about discipleship, right? How do we disciple our people, right? What do we do here, right? I mean, we're like a multi-level marketing organization for discipling people, you know? I mean, we're like Amway for that, you know? Somebody sponsors me, and I sponsor somebody who sponsors somebody, you know? And we can bring that to the church. We can bring that. And I decided to do that way back when. And And I hadn't really been a church guy, but I, based on what he shared in that meeting, I did. Because I thought that, you know what, we do, we've got something to bring here. Well, when I got to church, I discovered something that was troubling. It was part of a church home group. And in that church home group, there were a whole bunch of people who had sobered up in AA or NA. Then they started going to church. And then they decided that they didn't need the 12 steps anymore. They just needed one step, Jesus. And which I, you know, I'm fine with him and all that. But they didn't need the 12 steps anymore, and they didn't need to go to meetings anymore because they were redeemed, and they were cured, and they were healed, and what have you. And all the old things had passed away, and now I'm just looking forward to running after the prize and all that. Problem was that, you know, 8 of them were drunk again or using. And now the good news is that 7 of them came back, but the bad news is that Earl didn't make it, and Earl took 5 with him driving the wrong way up I-35. And it was that, with that event, I decided, you know what? These Christians, these church-going people, they need to see that the big book comes right from their tradition. Right? They need to understand that. So I got together. Well, first, I read a book by a guy named Vic B. with 35 years sober on the biblical roots of the 12-step movement. And then I read a couple more. And I got together with my Big Book Dick, Ben Cartwright, Jesse Garza, Arthur Matsugimba, Dr. Ray, and my wife Pat. We got together and we decided we wanted to start a group where we could talk about that. And we decided intentionally that it would not be an AA group, although Dick B. makes an argument where it could, and that happens in places. But I thought that just, we didn't need to do that. So we started a group, a special group, and the idea being that I wanted to get the Bible thumpers into the big book. But I also wanted to get big book thumpers, like me, at the time, to understand the Bible a little better. And so we've done it every Friday night since 2001, Pioneer Group, and have done it for the last 8 years at Haven for Hope on Tuesday nights. And, you know, what I've learned is this, is that the guys, I like to say this, the guys that wrote this Bible sure stole a lot from the guys that wrote this thing right here. Right? They sure did. But it's just, it's been a great way for us to enhance through prayer, meditations, and study our understanding of spirituality, our understanding of ourselves, and our understanding of God. You know, I came to understand, or not to understand, but I came up with a way to approach the Bible through the lens of the big book that's been very helpful for me. Now, I'm able to look at the big book through the lens of Scripture as well. I'm able to go both ways. Now, you'll never hear me talking about that in a meeting, ever. I don't think I've ever said anything about that in a meeting, because this is Alcoholics Anonymous. This isn't, you know, come join my church, Anonymous. You know, or this is not the church of the 20% tithe, double the blessing, right? It's not that either. And but it's Alcoholics Anonymous. But you know, that's an important part of my growing spirituality, is that group and what that's been like for me. So we've run out of time here. I'd like to thank the committee. Roger, I'd like to thank Greg S. for telling me to do this. Voluntold me to do this. And I'd like to thank you all for listening. And I'd like to thank you for my sobriety.
Thank you, Chris. We appreciate it. I think most people in this room know Chris and